Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. KSFR is also moving up the dial to 101.1 FM. For the next few months, we're simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM, KSFR Santa Fe Public Radio. So we're now broadcasting throughout northern New Mexico. My own website, where we are podcasting this show, is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Coco Fusco, an artist who is showing her work, her film, in the latest exhibition at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and Diane Karp will be with us as well. Right now, I'd like to welcome Cindy Bellinger. She is author of the book Journaling for Women, Write, Doodle, Scribble, and Meet Yourself Up Close. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
It's good to have you. Now, keeping a journal, first of all, why women?
Because it's mostly a genre for women, even though, you know, men, of course, have kept logs and journals and diaries. But I think that women really are attracted to this because we've been so cloistered through history into these roles that sometimes our only means of expression is writing in a diary, keeping a journal. You need someone to talk to sometimes, and so you write in a journal.
And now that we're not so cloistered, and now that we have many more means of self-expression, how has the role of the journal changed, if it has?
I know a lot of people keep the blogs and online journals, but I really think and I really believe, and I still do this, you know, just take out my little blank book and sit down and I call it handheld thoughtfulness, and I think we need more of that these days.
Handheld, meaning that you hold the book in your hand.
You hold it, and you write in it, you use a pen, you get away from the computer, you get away from all the digital stuff that's trying to pull at us.
Now, do you know people who write their journals on the computer as well? Not necessarily blogs to be published, but just private journals.
Yeah, I do.
Do you think there's really a difference?
You know, and I have tried it, and yeah, there is a difference. I feel, and maybe it's because so much of my work I do on the computer, I feel like it needs to be more polished when I write it on the computer, rather than, you know, just scratching stuff in the journal with a pen.
Now, is a journal an end in itself, or is it a vehicle for other things?
It can be a vehicle, and I have used this for other pieces of writing. But I think mostly it is just what it is, just an end in itself. Just writing down, you can use it for 5 minutes or a minute once a week, once a month. Sometimes I go to it 5 times a day, and that's it. You write in it, and it's done.
And how long have you been keeping a journal yourself?
Since I was 10, about 47 years.
And do you go back and reread them ever?
I do. It's rather enlightening. I have moved a lot through my life, and I've lugged these journals with me, and I'm always peeking into them when I'm moving, and I'm always amazed at how smart I was a long time ago, or geez, did I really think that and not do anything about it? I mean, it's a real eye-opener to go back and look at the old journals.
I would think that sometimes it wouldn't be necessarily that pleasant. I mean, if you figured out things when you were 16 and then didn't do anything about them, and then 30 years later you're repeating the same patterns.
Right. Well, I think that's real common in journals, is that when you sit down and write, certain themes do start reoccurring, you know, I guess we call them issues now. You know, they're just gonna keep coming up unless we do something about them, and they still might, and we just might look at them a little differently in 10 years.
We're talking to Cindy Bellinger about her book, Journaling for Women. What's the value that you found in keeping a journal every day?
Well, I don't do it every day. But I try to, but it's not necessary to do that. But what it makes me feel more connected to my own life when I can tack down a day, when I can zero into some event that's happening in my life, it just makes me feel a little bit more connected.
So what is the process you actually go through? Is there, I mean, you've written a book about it, presumably to teach women how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it?
But what I start with in the book, and a lot of times I will just do it myself, is sit down and write I call it right off the surface, just skim the highlights that went through the day. Just write them down. And then I go back and circle one that particularly stands out. And then I may go into that a little bit deeper, find another layer of reflection.
So, the visual part of it also? Do you draw pictures? Do you do things besides write narrative?
Oh yeah. I draw these little squiggles. I draw diagrams because a lot of events, feelings, just feel more tangible when I can draw a little sketch of it. And it lets another part of my interior world, I guess, be a little bit more revealed in another way by a little sketch, by a little doodle.
Now, is a journal, your journal, something that you share with other people ever, or do you always keep it very private? What's the privacy issue surrounding journals?
Actually, I think that's one of the hindrances that keeps people from writing a journal, is the fear that someone may read it. I do have a girlfriend, and when we get together, sometimes we'll share entries out of our journals. But mostly it's private, it's for me. And I think, oh geez, when I die, pity the poor person has to read, you know, go through the journals, you know.
Although, I mean, you certainly have the power to destroy them first. I know plenty of people
right.
have done that.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to. And I worry about, you know, my house burning. I live in the forest, and I worry about that. And I think, oh, geez, my journals. But if they go, they go.
I was once, years ago, at a writing workshop with an author named Dina Metzger, and she was uh-huh. talking about a correspondence she had with a very close friend, and they went back and forth and had this profound sharing, and then they made it public, like they read it aloud to some people, or they published some of their letters,
uh-huh.
and it ruined the correspondence. They could never go back to that place.
Right.
And I
right.
wondered if when you start working with the journal in a different way, like sharing it, whether some transaction happens, which just changes the whole energy.
I do know that when I'm writing, and this isn't conscious, it's just afterwards, I think, oh, well, that would be a neat entry to share with Cy, you know, my friend, and I just make a note of it and just move on. But I do have a back and forth correspondence with a friend. She lives in Ohio, and we do email, and that in the form is kind of a journal, and a lot of those I will clip out, I will print them out and paste them in my journal.
What has it done for you? Has it kept you grounded? I mean, would you say that there's a therapeutic value or creative value? What is it? What's it
all done of for that?
You?
All of the, it's very therapeutic, and it does keep me grounded, and a lot of times it is a springboard for more creative work. of those three, I would choose that it's more therapeutic. It's very cathartic, and it's let me work through a lot of personal dilemmas, problems, issues, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
And do you teach workshops? Do you bring people together around the whole journal writing thing?
I do. Yeah, I first started teaching journal writing in 1974. And when I moved from Colorado, moved to Los Alamos in 79, and I started teaching journal writing there. And those classes is the basis of the book that has just come out.
You worked in radio before, too.
I did.
What did you do?
I covered all the news coming out of Los Alamos. I did that for about a year. And covered the labs, covered county council, covered the school board, covered the local spelling bee. I mean, it was really fun up there.
Do you find that when you're in a very externally focused life that your journal writing changes?
A lot of time I don't have the time for it when there's a lot going on. And that's when sometimes I really need to consciously say, okay, I'm gonna take 15 minutes here and write in my journal.
We're talking to Cindy Bellinger. The book is called Journaling for Women, Write, Doodle, Scribble, and Meet Yourself Up Close. What else do you want to tell people about the... I mean, is this something that you think everybody benefits from, or do you have to have a certain, what would you call it, inner need and desire to express yourself in this way?
I think it's an inner need and a desire. A lot of people they just can't get into it. They don't see the value. They don't want to try it. But for those who are very drawn to it, I think it's very meaningful and very validating. You know, it really makes a lot of your life significant.
To you, anyway.
Well, to the person who's doing it, yeah.
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 I have to say, I got one of those blank books for my birthday when I was 13.
Uh-huh.
And I started writing in it, and I filled dozens and dozens of these things over the years, and stopped some years ago and kept it on the computer, which I find much better. And in fact, all the privacy issues are completely gone. You just password protect your file and that's it. You don't have to worry about privacy. But I found that when I went back to, and I don't like rereading them at all, but in the few times I've gone back to high school journal entries, a lot of them were like, I'm so mad. And when you
with
have,
no specifics.
Well, yeah, it says
right?
specific. Yeah. I'm mad at this person or that person. But when you look at that, it has no value whatsoever.
Uh-huh. But it did at the time.
It did, but it didn't help. It didn't get the emotion out. It just got it on the page, but it didn't transform it the way writing, let's say, a story or a piece of literature or a poem or something like that would have. And then when you look back on it, it's so unspecific. And it seems to me that the only things that were of real value in that whole process, for me personally, were when very specific stories with actual detail about that day or about that event or whatever were recorded, as opposed to the emotion inside.
Mm-hmm. Because through those events, you can probably, even if they're, you know, just minimal notes,
you can remember something that you would never have remembered otherwise.
Right, yeah. That's one of the powers of writing down your day. You can go back 25 years later and go, oh, I remember that. Whereas you would have forgotten it if you hadn't even jotted something down.
Well, Cindy Bellinger, anything else you want to tell our audience about the process of journal writing or your book?
Well, actually what's happening is a lot of people are contacting me to figure out how to start. I think there's another movement in journal writing. I mean, journal writing has always been around, but I see these waves, and through my website, a lot of people are contacting me. How do I start? What do I do? What kind of a book do I use? And I do recommend blank journals, because the lines get kind of confining.
When you think about it, when somebody has to write to somebody else to say, what kind of book do I use?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty pathetic.
Well, they just don't know, you know.
They can use whatever kind of book they want.
Right, but they don't know that, you know, if they... That's who this book is for. People just starting out.
Well, the book is called Journaling for Women, and it is published by
Sunstone Press.
That's right. What I thought, right here in Santa Fe.
Santa Fe.
And you've got a website, CindyBellinger.com, CindyBellinger, and there is a publishing party for this and a few other Sunstone books on Sunday, the 15th of July, this coming Sunday. And for more information, people can call 983-5615. I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Coco Fusco. She's an artist whose film, Operation Atropos, runs continuously at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's part of the exhibition Comfort Zone. And Diane Karp, who's the director of the Santa Fe Art Institute, who's put this whole Comfort Zone together. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning.
It's great to have you. And little Aurelio, who is also here with us on the radio. Diane, first of all, tell us about the exhibition Comfort Zone.
The exhibition Comfort Zone is an example of what we do every year. Every year, for those who don't know what the Santa Fe Art Institute is, I should probably start really at the base. We're an art center whose mission is to explore those connections and intersections of the contemporary arts and social issues. And every year, at the very core of our program, we have artists and writers and choreographers and composers who come from all over the world, who come to the Santa Fe Art Institute to make work, to work on bodies of work that they've been developing over years, to start new work. And it's an environment where we provide support and time and space and ask for nothing in return. And the artists and writers form a community within the Institute and connect to the community outside of the Institute to build relationships so that the artists become those members of their society who can address serious, compelling social issues. They make work that allows us to look at it and think about it, things that we never get from the media. Everything is hit in a flash and a bit. And if there's a real serious issue that an artist is involved with or interested in, they can make work that gives us the permission and the luxury of spending time thinking about it, looking hard at it. And each year we pick a theme and we invite outstanding creators from all different parts of the creative activity community, and we invite them to come and bring their expertise and their brilliance to the residency program and to the community at large. And this year we decided we were going to focus on the artist as activist for political issues, for social issues, for cultural issues, for environmental issues. And we were looking for a title, and we kept saying, what we really want is we want for people to understand that artists are able to push us out of our comfort zone, out of that space where we have sort of developed a kind of reasoned indifference to all the stuff that goes on in the world.
As my friend the minister says, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable.
Exactly. And so what we decided was to shorten the title from Out of the Comfort Zone to Comfort Zone, and begin to talk about the fact that we each develop our own comfort zones, and they protect us. They protect us from thinking, they protect us from engaging, they protect us from actually making a difference in the world.
And sometimes, it's an adaptive protection,
It is an adaptive protection, absolutely. And so the artists that we are bringing in this year are all artists who make very important work that nudges us out of the comfort zone, makes us think about the important issues in the world today.
So you really didn't name it after the mattress and furniture store on Cerritos Road?
No, and what we were thinking was, you know, it's like that old phrase that that Cézanne said he wanted his art to be like an easy chair. He didn't really mean that. What he meant was he wanted his art to be a space where people could sit long enough to actually look hard at what it was that he was making. And in fact, Cézanne as well pushed people way out of their comfort zone at the time.
Let's talk about your film, Coco Fusco, Operation Atropos. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let's talk about the name Atropos. Who is Atropos?
Well, Atropos is the Greek fate who cuts the thread of life. She decides when people die. And the piece is about my training with retired U.S. Army interrogators who offer courses to civilians, mini courses, on how to survive as a prisoner of war or how to interrogate prisoners of war. And I took this course to prepare myself to create a performance piece about being a woman interrogator in the Army right now in military prisons like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
And so the film opens with this statement that I think probably is true for many people, is that part of what shocked us, the American public, about the Abu Ghraib photographs was that there's so many women interrogators.
Well, actually, the women in uniform in those pictures are not interrogators, they're military police.
The word you used was victimizers.
Yeah, what surprised me when I saw it was to see so many women in the role of victimizer, because my understanding of torture up until that point had always put women on the side of being the victims of torture, right? And that made me look into, what were all these women doing there? Why are there so many women in the military now? Why are there so many women in military intelligence? I mean, military police are not in intelligence. It's a separate division. But in this particular case of Abu Ghraib, the group that was working in the area where those photographs were taken were working directly for military intelligence. It was an irregular situation.
So how did you go through the steps of coming toward taking a training course, and how did you even find this? What was it called? Delta?
Team Delta.
Team Delta.
Well, if I were an actor working for film or television and I had to prepare for a role where I had to be a member of a particular profession, whether it's a waitress or a lawyer, I'd probably trail some real person from that profession around to give myself an idea of what their daily life is like, how they have to speak when they're on the job, what they have to do, right? Well, I wanted to make a piece about a female interrogator in the Army, and I didn't know anybody in the military, so I had to figure out a way to get close to people who have military experience, who do the trade that I was interested in depicting in my work. So I started thinking about, I read things, but when you read a book, it doesn't give you a sense of what people are actually like, right? And through research, some, you know, internet research, I found that there are several kinds of courses that you can take on interrogation, but some of them are more classroom oriented. This particular course given by Team Delta involves immersive simulation, which means you do a kind of enactment, almost as if you were preparing for a play, like rehearsing, right? Where you, in our case, we played prisoners of war and we were interrogated. And these guys have been doing this since the late 90s. They started Team Delta. And they, as I said, they offer these two kinds of classes, one on surviving as prisoners of war and others on interrogation.
So the film, which is a very interesting film to watch, you and a bunch of your friends, basically, mm-hmm. Who seemed like, I mean, it was almost comical at the beginning when you were being filmed. It's like one of them said, "Do you think they'll let me continue to take my herbs?"
Yeah, yeah.
And you have the sense of these sort of well-educated, nice, middle-class, you know, leftist ladies who are taking this class, where they then play the role of human rights workers who are abducted in a small, you know, mythical country somewhere.
Right. Uh-huh.
And these interrogators put on fake accents and put hoods over your heads and take you away and so on. And then you have to go through this fake interrogation. And I wondered, to what extent did it feel real? Because, of course, you knew that they weren't going to actually rape you.
Yeah. Okay. When I show this work, people often ask me, you know, what does this tell you about being a prisoner, like real prisoners? I said, it doesn't tell me anything about being a real prisoner. But I wasn't trying to find out what it was like to be a real prisoner. I was trying to find out what it was like to be a soldier. And in that sense, the training that we got is a truncated version of what elite forces get. So we were getting a mini course that's like what soldiers get in the Army when they're going to be part of the Green Berets or the Rangers, to learn how to survive hostile interrogations in a prisoner of war situation. And they also know that they're not going to get killed. They also volunteered. They also know that it's going to end at a certain point. But what you try to do in those classes is get yourself to a stress point where the physical, psychological, and emotional stress could unnerve you so that you would have a taste of what might happen to you if you're in the real situation. And supposedly, if you train enough in that kind of scenario, then you know your memory of that kicks in when you're in the real world situation of being captured.
Just as the self-defense training classes that we have here in Santa Fe get you into an adrenalized state and you have to hit back and so on.
Exactly.
And in some sense. But so what happened? I mean, did you get, and your colleagues, your other friends, there were, 10 or 11 people?
No, there were seven of us, and four of them cracked and gave up the information they weren't supposed to give in the class. So the stress had that effect on them of actually they lost control of their... whatever, their powers of concentration, their ability to resist, right?
Even though they knew it was just a simulation.
Yeah, well, it was the combination of being disoriented. I mean, we were hooded a lot of the time. The physical stress, they made us do exercise all day long in really hot weather and really repetitive, boring exercises. They were yelling at us all the time, even when we were out in the pen, right? Because when you weren't being interrogated, each person got four interrogations. When you weren't being interrogated, you were out in a pen in the woods, in a barbed wire pen, being yelled at by these guys playing military police. And that the combination of all of those things was quite unnerving for some of the women in the group.
What about for you?
Well, you know, it was my idea, it was my project. So I wanted to get through it no matter what, so that I could feel like I had gotten the full experience, that I had learned something that I could take with me. But also, I'm a bit older than the other women. A lot of them were former students of mine. So, you know, I say, well, I have a little more real life experience of getting kicked around by real guys. So I'm not as likely to be shocked by the behavior of these teachers. But some of the women were just overwhelmed by the stress.
We're talking to Coco Fusco, and her film is called Operation Atropos, and it runs at the Santa Fe Art Institute. It's part of the exhibition Comfort Zone. What did you learn, what were you taught about resisting interrogation?
What we were taught about resisting interrogation is that open defiance can get you killed, and that doing the old-fashioned, I'm a soldier and I'm only going to give you my name, rank, and serial number, also isn't very effective. That the best way to survive, according to the military, is to pretend to comply and to behave as if you are weakened by illness or injury or disorientation so that you can slow down the process of their acquiring information from you. The longer
so you pretend, even before you are injured or disoriented, you pretend that they that
exactly,
you are.
That you can't sign the paper because you can't get your hands to actually hold the pen,
right.
That you are so disoriented that you can't remember all the things that you're supposed to be able to remember, that you're, you know, frightened and crying so much you can't answer the questions. Anything that you can do convincingly to put off having to give the information, that's what you're supposed to do.
And are the interrogators trained to understand the difference between fake?
Yes.
And what are some of those differences?
Well, they when we were in the classroom, because after we did the immersive simulation, then we went into a classroom scenario and broke down the experience that we had just gone through and then did exercises to try to play the other role of the interrogator. And what they showed us was the means that they use to try to determine whether a person is telling the truth. It runs from reading body language, eye movement. I mean, they have these paradigms for understanding human behavior that are very mathematical. And
some of it is hard to simulate, like pupil dilation or
exactly,
things like that.
Exactly. So that's what they're looking for, to have a radar to tell whether or not people are lying to them. It's to those things that are so hard to pretend.
Having learned some of those resistance techniques, did any of the women in your group successfully fool their interrogators?
Well, there was a woman who acted like she was really out of it and that she couldn't remember who she was and she couldn't answer anything and she was just sort of crying and moaning all the time. And they did call in a medic to make sure that she was okay because they were concerned that she might actually be hurt.
But she was playing.
She was playing, yeah.
Very interesting. Were you and any of the other women familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiments before you started doing the simulation?
Yes, and we actually talked about that in the in the class, and we also talked about another experiment. I can't remember the name of the scientist, but that happened at Yale in the, I believe it was early 60s.
The Milgram experiments.
Yeah, where people were asked to administer electroshocks to strangers, and they obeyed because the person giving the order was a guy who looked very professional in a white lab coat and was telling them that it was okay.
So knowing things like that, knowing, because I saw the Milgram film in freshman psychology way
right.
back when,
mm-hmm.
and even just seeing the film changes your life. Did it help you? Did it help the other people to have that kind of knowledge going into a very stressful interrogation situation?
Well, what I tried to show them was not necessarily the Stanford experiment, but to show them footage of Team Delta doing what they were going to do to us, doing it to other people,
uh-huh.
and gave them access to documents that I had and information about Team Delta so that they would have some idea. I said, it's not going to be exactly what you see because they change each game so that we're surprised, right, by what we encounter. But I didn't want anybody to go into it without any sense of what we were going to do. So, that was my way of saying, look, I'm trying to be as fair as I can. I'm not trying to force you into a situation in which you're going to feel awful and then you're going to get angry at me. I think when I teach courses, I teach at Columbia and I do teach courses on artist responses to war. And when we often talk about, what evil is. I think the thing about the Stanford experiment and the Milgram experiment is that it gets young people to think about whether or not human beings are evil because of some kind of innate quality or pathology, or whether anybody can be evil given, in a particular context, given the context. And I think it's much easier for people to believe that evil is something that's outside of their realm of possibility, that it's a matter of pathology or of some kind of genetic defect, and that what these experiments prove is that anybody can behave in an evil manner if the context is the right context.
And I think, I will freely admit that I have no idea what I would do under major stress because I've never encountered it.
Exactly. And when I took the class, and since taking the class, I've maintained a dialogue with the head of Team Delta because I was making a film and I was showing him the footage along the way, and he's come with me to give lectures sometimes when I've done presentations on the work, and he's interested in audience response, and he's made me also understand that I can't, it's easy to judge quickly, but you have to understand what it's like to be a soldier in that situation and just how terrifying it can be, even if you think you have all the power, when you're surrounded, as soldiers are in Abu Ghraib, by snipers who are shooting at them every time they step out a door.
It's something I was wondering about the guys who were doing the simulations, who themselves are retired military. Do you feel like, to some extent, they're getting off on, even though it's fake, wielding the power over these little...
Of course. Both of them said that they liked being interrogators. They joined the army to be interrogators. That's what they wanted to do. That it's there's something, but they have a sense of it, like a good technician in any profession, that you want your technique to be the best technique. That's what they're interested in. They're much more interested in talking about techniques and about techniques where they don't have to administer any physical pressure, where they can feel like they finessed you, by fooling you, rather than harming you in a physical way. So that's what they focus a lot of their attention on when they talk about, why they do what they do, or why they've continued to do it in the class.
What kind of insights did this give you about Abu Ghraib, about Iraq, about the whole set of things that was so shocking to Americans when the pictures came out?
Well, there are some issues that can't be answered by a class like this, which have to do with chain of command. Who gave the orders, right? But I think the American public was told at the beginning, once the photos came out from Abu Ghraib, that it was just a rogue element, that these kids were out of control. But what many people were trying to understand is whether or not it was a chain of command thing or a rogue element, how do people who didn't behave that way before come to behave that way in that scenario? And that's what I think the course was illuminating. Well, even though what you see in the photographs is the actions of military police, the orders came from interrogators. So how does the training that an interrogator receives, how does that begin to inure them to violence? How does it begin to allow people to rationalize the use of force that can put one in a situation in which abuse then becomes not abuse, or even acceptable, even though it is abuse? the conversations I had with my teachers and the exercises that we did helped me to understand that, the process of rationalization. And I think that that's important because
it's
only a few interrogators and military police have come forward and say that they are have moral problems with what they're being ordered to do. The majority of them have followed orders, and it is known now that there have been orders to torture and have been orders to abuse people. And even there are many things that civilians would call abuse that the military doesn't even consider abuse. And there are things like hooding, which some human rights organizations call torture, which, you know, are still practiced and not considered torture by military code.
Well, so having been hooded, where do you weigh in on that?
I don't think that I can speak to the experience of a prisoner because non-consensual situations are totally different from consensual situations. And it's not just consent, it's also the time limit factor that I know the hood will come off at a certain point. But if you look at what has happened, for example, to Jose Padilla, who was declared an enemy combatant and accused of terrorism, he has gone insane as a result of the treatment that he's received as a prisoner. So, you know, and what's the treatment? Total sensory deprivation, right, that goes on and on and on. And that also includes extensive periods of hooding and, you know, having all hearing blocked by special headphones and whenever he's moved, et cetera, et cetera. He's not fit to be tried. Is that an indicator to me that this kind of treatment shouldn't be used? Yeah, it is an indicator.
We're speaking with Coco Fusco. The film is called Operation Atropos, and it runs at the Santa Fe Art Institute's Comfort Zone exhibition, which is open from 9 to 5 every weekday. What about there were 7 of you women, 4 out of the 7, the majority, cracked under the pressure, even though they knew it was a simulation. What was it like for them afterwards? What was the process of debriefing and for them coming to terms with the fact that they betrayed their comrades?
I mean, I certainly never told any of them that they betrayed us, right? Because I think that that's a pretty strong language.
But I would have felt that way if I had been in their position.
They felt that they felt justified in giving up because they thought that they were protecting another prisoner from being beaten. So that every single person who cracked under the same conditions. They felt that they were protecting another member of the group. So they felt that that was a more important thing to do to protect another member than to keep the secret. I think that some of the women were embarrassed by how easy it had been to crack them. I showed each person the material, once the film was done, and they were quite surprised, many of them, when they saw it, that, oh, my God, that's all that happened? That's all they did? And look at how I became, and, God, I should have known better. But in the heat of the moment, with the stress and the disorientation factors added in, it feels very different than when you're looking at it in the comfort of a living room. And so I think that some of them were surprised. I think a couple of the women were quite angry at the end of the course. They just, and you know, one of them had said to Marshall, one of the interrogators, I think you're really sick. And that's why he says at the end, you know, I'm not sick. I'm not an asshole. I'm not this. I'm not that. So, I think that some of them had difficulty separating themselves from the person in the experience, even though I had tried before we went into the class to say, this is not about you. You don't have to reveal anything about your real self in this process. This is all about pretending to be a human rights worker in another country or whatever role they give us, right? And so, but that doesn't stop people from what they feel in the moment.
Now, you also had to take the role of interrogator, which is much less documented in the film for the audience, but I assume it took you spent as much time on that as you did on being the victimizee.
Well,
the
victim. We actually spend a lot of time being lectured to and getting a lot of information on it and then doing some exercises very briefly. The thing is, we weren't very good in the exercises because we were just beginning, and these guys are experts, right?
So one could see that. You were sort of trying not to giggle.
Yeah, they were just impenetrable. And they could take anything that we said to them and twist it around and have their way. But also because I felt, and I think that some of the other women in the group realized when we were doing the exercise, that this is very difficult work, that it does require skill, that you do have to be trained and you do have to be good at it, and not everybody can be good at it. You realize, oh my God, it's not just straight question answer here at all.
One of the things that gets talked about quite a lot and that I am very curious about is to what extent does interrogation, you know, that borders on or is or torture or that is very difficult for people, to what extent does it yield truth? To what extent does it yield intelligence?
What the teachers I worked with said was that, you know, torture doesn't yield reliable information, and so that it's better not to do it precisely because it's not efficient, right? Whether or not it's right or wrong, it's just not efficient. That said, you know, they also said things like they know about ticking bomb situations and in which it has been necessary to go a little bit overboard, and that, you know, there are times when you have to consider that as a possibility.
Although the ticking bomb situation is basically a Hollywood scenario rather than something that happens in real life.
Well,
namely, there's a ticking time bomb with a clock on it, and if you don't get the information, then they'll blow up Newark.
I can't say for sure that I know that for a fact, but what I was told by them was that they do know of real situations in which there was a ticking bomb and in which, or something akin to a ticking bomb. So, you know, all I'm telling you is what they told me, right? That the military does consider that there are, because it doesn't necessarily have to be a ticking bomb that's going to blow up Newark, but it could be a minefield that your troops are about to walk into without knowing, right? And you need to get that information to them. Right. So, I'm sorry, I forgot what your question was.
To what extent does it really yield true information?
Well, the thing is, what they consider actionable intelligence is they have a lower threshold than what a civil court would consider truthful information. A lot of things are actionable intelligence that are not necessarily where is the ticking bomb, for example. And also, you can give up information about yourself or about your peers inadvertently, not through direct questioning, but through inadvertently in a stress situation. And that probably wouldn't be accepted in a civil court. But in a wartime situation, in an interrogation, everything that is told can be used, no matter what condition you were in when you gave up that information. So you have to take that into account.
But the question is it true? I mean,
you have to understand, yes, that there are people who under pressure will lie. But you also have to understand that there's a lot of information that interrogators ask for that isn't about, are you a terrorist, where's Al-Qaeda, and where's the bomb? Some of it is, you know, where's the next convoy going? You know, where are your airplanes flying? Where is this? They're more general battlefield questions, or simply, who are you, and, you know, like, what do you do, and what's your job like, and, you know, who comes into your office, kind of things, where they're trying to, intelligence is used to try to get the big picture, the concepts. It's not just about finding the criminal. In a way, the current scenario of, you know, looking for Al-Qaeda and looking for the bombs and looking for the terrorists has distorted public understanding of what military intelligence is designed to do. There are a lot of intelligence experts that just look for secret messages in foreign newspapers, who just stand on the street and listen over and listen to people's conversations on the street because they're cryptolinguists. So, or who listen to radio programs on foreign radio all day long and decipher them for the Pentagon. So that's also actionable intelligence, you see what I mean? And it's not so much about a live or die situation or a concrete and very clear-cut truth or falsehood situation. So that's the thing, that they're looking for a lot more than when it comes down to the bomb and are you a terrorist and Al-Qaeda, then that's a very specific kind of scenario, and only top specialists would be brought in at that point. And my somewhat educated guess at this point is, for example, when they found Saddam, and they found him a few days after finding one of the top-ranking guys, I think they probably really pressed that guy to the wall and did some things that we don't want to hear about in order to get that information.
What about people who haven't done anything and who are just the wrong person and they're brought in? And
that
they
happens.
Say, I know nothing, and they keep on pressing them. Are there situations where people will just say anything in order to get them to stop?
Sure, and not just in a war. I mean, that happens in, you know, I know people who that's happened to in Mexico.
False confessions.
Yeah, false confessions. The police want to find, they want a guilty person. They want someone to to claim responsibility for a crime so they can look like they are cleaning up, right? And, I mean, that happens all the time. It happens in NYPD in New York. But in a military situation, you go through several levels before you become what is now called a security detainee. You might be picked up on a battlefield, and you might just be, you know, some civilian who happened to be there, or a soldier who's low-ranking and doesn't have very much information. And the field interrogators, who are just there to basically figure out who people are, may dismiss you really quickly. Now, in the current situation in Abu Ghraib, there's so many people who are in there who are petty criminals who have nothing to do with it, but they're trying so desperately to crack an insurgency that they will interrogate people endlessly. And also in Guantanamo, where now there are hundreds of guys who they can't prove anything, but they've been in prison forever and they just keep interrogating them and interrogating them. I suspect that many of those people have not confessed to doing anything, but that some have in order to just stop the interrogation.
So where do you go from here? You've made the film. It's an hour long. Are you going to do performances on the basis of all this material?
Well, I created two different performances based on the experience of the training. One I did in Brazil in 2005 that was called Bear Life Study, and that was really about the choreography of the choreography inside the military prison, how prisoners are forced to move in unison and to perform certain movements in a ritualistic manner in order to enforce the division between them as the prisoner and the soldiers as the captors, right? And then I wrote a monologue about being a female interrogator called A Room of One's Own that I've been touring with for the last year, and I'll probably continue for another year with that piece. And I'm also now working on a book with Seven Stories Press.
And Diane Karp, there's lots more work in the Comfort Zone exhibition at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
Absolutely. There are surveillance photographs by David Mizell, which is turning the tables on the military. David Mizell is a wonderful aerial photographer who is very involved and interested in environmental issues. And he overflew a couple of the military installations in the U.S., and has these extraordinary photographs that look very beautiful, and in fact they are beautiful, but they are dangerously deceptive because they are photographs of the installation bunkers that hold nerve gas and other sort of awful elements of war.
Which you have to know, you can't see that from the photograph.
Right. We have very little label on the wall because what we want people to do is take the time to look at the work. And so there's a small catalog that's sort of like a newsprint flyer, so you can get the information. Coco's film, we have a wonderful film by Juan Manuel Echevarria, which is Two Brothers. It's the songs that were created in response to watching the massacres in Colombia by the drug cartels. Not retaliatory, just sad songs that air human emotion. We have work by Edgar Heapabirds. We have signs that he created about the Trail of Tears that are like roadside signs asking, did you walk? Did you walk by choice? Did you walk to Oklahoma? There's also work by Barbara Hammer, a wonderful experimental filmmaker whose issues are gender issues and the lesbian community. We have work as well by a wonderful young man named Harold Fletcher, which is a community video he did at Ray's garage in Seattle, where Ray and all of his mechanics and the clients got to read James Joyce's Ulysses.
Which is great.
And read it brilliantly.
It's great.
So it just says you don't have to be a genius to read Joyce.
All that and much, much more at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thank you, Diane Karp, and thank you, Coco Fusco.
Thank you. Thanks, Mary Charlotte. This was great.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And by the way, Santa Fe Art Institute is on the web at sfai.org, and the number is 424-5050, and they're open 9 to 5 on weekdays. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also moving up the dial to 101.1 FM. For the next few months, we're simulcasting with 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. It's all KSFR Santa Fe Public Radio. You can go to my website, santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear this show and the whole archive of shows any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can subscribe to the show also on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.